So remember then that these last few chapters of Revelation that we've been looking at, they have been dominated by two sequences of seven seals of the scroll and seven trumpets. As for the seven seals, we've been right through all of those. As for the seven trumpets, we've reached number six. And you would expect that this morning we'd be looking at trumpet number seven, but once again we have one of these lengthy interludes that you get periodically in the book of Revelation, and so the seventh trumpet doesn't actually come until the last part of Revelation 11 that we're not looking at this morning. And so, as I say then, we're dealing this morning with an interlude within the seven trumpets, and the interesting thing about this interlude is that actually it takes us back again to the scroll. It's a kind of recapping interludes. Now, the seals aren't actually mentioned. There's no reference to the seven seals, but certainly the scroll in chapter 10 is quite prominent, isn't it? You'll have noticed that as I read the passage, that there's quite an emphasis on the scroll. And so it's almost as if there's a concern here that we might be getting so caught up with the trumpets that we've forgotten the seals of the scroll that came before the trumpets. And so this interlude, as I say, it's kind of recapping for us. It's taking us back again to think once again about the scroll. And in this interlude then, something which might seem rather bizarre happens. John eats the scroll. He's told to eat it, and sure enough, at the end of chapter 10, John eats this scroll. Now, of course, this is not a literal detail, nor, I think, is there any great symbolic significance in the actual eating of the scroll. The whole point is the effect that it has on him. He finds it both bitter and sweet, doesn't he? There's that emphasis at the end of the chapter. He finds the scroll both bitter and sweet. So you might go and watch a film at the cinema, and the film might be somewhat harrowing, or it might just in some way be quite unpleasant, and someone might ask you afterwards, well, what did you think of the film? How did you find the film? And you might say, well, it left a bad taste in my mouth. Now, of course, you're really only there giving half a metaphor, aren't you? If you were to give the complete metaphor, you'd have to say, well, I sat down in the cinema and picture it as though I ate the film. And I ate the film, and then afterwards it left a bad taste in my mouth. That would be the complete metaphor, but you don't say that, but you just say, well, it left a bad taste in my mouth. And it's as if here, John then is giving the complete metaphor. His point really is that this scroll, it left a strange mixture of taste in his mouth, bitter and sweet. But just to give the complete metaphor, he includes the fact that he ate it first. But the point then that we're to focus on, and really the point that I think is the hinge of our whole passage this morning, is this then, that to John, in John's perception, the scroll is bitter and also sweet. And all I want to do this morning then is ask two questions. How is the scroll bitter, and how is the scroll sweet? So for question number one then, how is the scroll bitter? Well, before we answer that, I suppose we need to remind ourselves what the scroll is. So the scroll, you remember, first appeared in chapter 5. And we said in our exposition of that chapter that the scroll then is really just God's plan. God's plan for this whole AD period, from Christ's first coming to Christ's second coming. All that's going to take place in this period of history that we're now living in, that is all contained in the scroll. That's what the scroll is. It's God's plan. But remember then that as in chapter 6, the scroll is opened up by Christ. Remember that what emerges is this. That a major theme then of history in this AD period, a major theme is Satan waging war against Christ's people. Satan waging this concerted campaign against Christ's people, especially, although not exclusively, focused on persecution. That is a major theme of history of this AD period. Now, we mustn't get confused with the seven trumpets that we've looked at more recently. Remember, the trumpets, we've said, are God's judgments against unbelievers. That's something quite different. That's a different aspect of history. God's judgments against unbelievers, especially his deepening of unbelievers' allegiance to their idols, that kind of blinding that's going on all the time. That's what the trumpets are about, God's judgments against unbelievers. But the main theme of the scroll, I'm saying, was Satan's attacks on believers, on Christ's people. So we need to be clear on that. And so, as I say then, the scroll showed us that a major theme of this AD period is Satan constantly attacking Christ's people through persecution. And that then is confirmed now that we come to our passage this morning. And this theme of persecution, this theme of Christ's people being under attack, it's quite pronounced here, isn't it? So look at chapter 11 and verse 2, where we have this reference to the holy city. In the last part of verse 2, the holy city being trampled. Now, the holy city is mentioned again in chapter 21, verse 2, and there it's explicitly identified as the New Jerusalem, the bride of Christ. It's the church. The holy city is Christ's people, the church. And we're being told there in verse 2 of the church then being trampled on by its enemies, being attacked, being assaulted, being besieged by its enemies. So that speaks of persecution. And then as chapter 11 proceeds, the image of the holy city gives way to another image, the image of two witnesses. Now, these two witnesses, again, I think, are the church. They're Christ's people. We'll talk a bit more about why there's two of them later on. But just suffice to say at this point, that's what they symbolize. That's what they signify. They signify the church of Christ. And again, then, there's this emphasis on the church being battered, being assaulted, being attacked. Look at verses 7 and 8. Where we have this reference to the beast. Now, the beast we'll encounter more later on in Revelation. It's an image taken from Daniel. And in Daniel, there are these four beasts, and they're specific earthly powers, earthly kingdoms. Here in Revelation, the beast, I don't think, stands for any one particular earthly power. It just stands for earthly power generically, earthly authority. And here then, the beast, you see, it lays into the church, these two witnesses. It makes war on them, verse 7. It conquers them, and it kills them, verse 7. And so we have this concept again of the church in this AD period being bruised and battered by its enemies. And that then is the very simple reason why John finds the scroll bitter. Because the scroll makes it clear that one major theme of this AD period is persecution. It's Satan attacking the church and assaulting it and harming it in all kinds of ways. And John then finds that a painful theme to think about. He finds it bitter. And so should we, shouldn't we? We live in a day when the church is being persecuted like never before, literally like never before. In our world today, there are vast swathes of the Christian church that in very direct, very explicit ways are being persecuted. And like John here, our reaction should be to be pained by that, shouldn't it? We shouldn't just sit back and say, well, at least things are pretty good here in the West. at least things are easy for us, and well, these are people we've never met and are on the other side of the world and so on. But we should be pained. This is a bitter theme to the writer of Revelation, and so it should be to us this morning, that Satan is waging this war against Christ's church. There is persecution going on in very severe forms. So that's our first question this morning. How is the scroll bitter? But then our second question that we need to spend a little bit longer on, how is the scroll sweet? How is the scroll sweet? Because if then the scroll shows that one of the great themes of history is Satan attacking Christ's church, well, you can see how that's bitter, but how on earth could John find that sweet? How is there any sweetness about that theme? How can there be anything good about this? Well, the answer to that question is the same as in chapter 6. And it's this, that Christ is the one who's controlling everything. The scroll is in the hand of Christ. Now, you might say, no, you're wrong about that. Yes, certainly in chapter 6, the scroll was in the hand of Christ, the Lamb. But here in chapter 10, the scroll's not in the hand of Christ. Surely it's in the hand, we're told in verse 1, of a mighty angel. Well, I take it that this mighty angel is the Lord Jesus Christ. I mean, for a start, he isn't just referred to as an angel. He is referred to as this mighty angel. That immediately seems to distinguish him from the ordinary angels that we encounter elsewhere in Revelation. And then look at the other things we're told about him. We're told that he's wrapped in a cloud, verse 1. Well, you know from the Old Testament that a cloud always signifies the divine presence, the presence of God himself. No ordinary angel would dare to come wrapped in a cloud like this. Then again, there's a rainbow over his head. We read of a rainbow in chapter 4. The rainbow encircled the divine throne. So again, that indicates that this is a divine figure, not a mere ordinary angel. Then again, his face is like the sun. Well, that's exactly the same as the vision John had of Christ in chapter 1. Christ's face shone like the sun. Then again, he has fiery legs, doesn't he? His legs like pillars of fire, verse 1, which isn't quite identical to the vision of Christ in chapter 1. There it was the feet were fiery, but it's similar sort of imagery. Then again, he roars like a lion, verse 3. And that immediately reminds us of the other lion we've encountered in Revelation. Chapter 5, the lion was Christ, wasn't it? And so I think all these touches are pointing us to this truth that this person we're meeting here in chapter 10 is none other than Christ himself. Now, it's not saying that Christ is an angel. Of course, he's not an angel. But again, this is probably assuming that the first readers had a deep knowledge of the Old Testament. And as such, they would have had another category of angel, quite apart from your ordinary angels, like the ones that appeared at Bethlehem or whatever. Because in the Old Testament, we have an angelic figure, don't we? Who's very mysterious, the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, who seems actually to be Yahweh himself. It's not just an ordinary angel, he's God. And so these readers who are very familiar with the Old Testament, they have this category of angel who is God. And they probably wouldn't have seen anything strange then in identifying Christ here with this mighty angel. So the scroll then is in the hand of Christ. And if that's not comforting enough, notice how the vision really underlines the grandeur of Christ's sovereign authority, doesn't it? So we have this business of the thunders in verses 3 and 4. And that he calls out and these seven thunders sound. And there's something a bit mysterious about this, because then the thunders sound and we don't know what the thunders were really, because John isn't allowed to tell us. And that kind of sets people's imaginations going, and people speculate all kinds of things that these thunders might have been. Sorry for being a spoilsport, but I think the explanation is much more mundane than that. So I think probably the thunders are just very similar to the trumpets. Probably just another series of divine judgments being poured out, and we don't really need to know what they were, because we've already been through the trumpets, and it would be repetition, and we don't really need it. And that's probably why John is told not to write it down, which raises the question, what's the point of mentioning it at all? And I think the point of mentioning it at all is just to underline that Christ is in control. It's he who called out, verse 3, and the seven thunders sounded. He's pulling the strings. He's controlling the universe. It's simply reminding us of Christ's sovereign authority. And then the other thing that really brings that out is just the sheer size of Christ in this vision. I mean, look at how he's standing, verse 2. His right foot is on the sea and his left foot on the land. He's standing astride the whole physical creation here. The recent referendum in Scotland has raised the question, hasn't it, whether the whole of the United Kingdom can be governed effectively from London, or whether there needed to be independence, or that now having not been voted for, whether there needs to be a devolution of more powers to Scotland. Can the whole of the United Kingdom be governed just from London? And can then Christ govern the whole universe? He's just one person. Can he govern the whole universe from heaven? And this passage is saying, yes, he can. It's kind of picturing the universe as just this tiny little model almost, and he stands over it. He's so mighty. He's so grand. He's so authoritative. I think actually that's the reason, incidentally, why the scroll is described as the little scroll. Some people have wondered why that is, and whether this is a different scroll from the one in chapter 5. I think it's the same scroll, and the point of it being little is it's little in comparison to Christ, because he's so big. The scroll is actually the same size as it's always been, but Christ is so big in this vision that the scroll just seems like a tiny postage stamp little book. And so it's emphasizing that Christ here is in control. And so, yes, the scroll may contain some disturbing realities. This war that Satan is waging against Christ's church, that's unnerving, it's bitter. But this is the sweet thing. The whole thing's in the control of Jesus Christ. It's not in the control of Satan. It's not in the control of the persecutors. Christ is the one who is holding the scroll. But let's probe that a bit further then, and ask what then that actually means, that practically, that Christ is in control. Over Satan's attacks against Christ's people, Christ is sovereign. What does that actually mean? And I just want to mention three things. First of all, it means that Satan's attacks are limited. The fact that Christ is in control, it means, number one, that Satan's attacks are limited. Now, those of you who have painful memories of maths lessons at school, and who in particular didn't get on very well with fractions, may sometimes find the book of Revelation a little bit unnerving. It contains a lot of fractions, doesn't it? Remember chapter 6, verse 8, we had death and Hades being given authority over a quarter of the earth. And then in chapter 8, we have a lot of thirds, a third of the trees being burned up, and a third of the living creatures, a third of the rivers, and so on. We have a lot of fractions. Now, the point of these fractions then isn't, again, that we are to kind of infer very precise, literal statistics from them. But rather, these fractions always come when nasty things are going on. And the point is to emphasize that the nasty thing, whatever that nasty thing is, it's limited. Because it can only damage a fraction of whatever. whether a half or a third or whatever, that doesn't really matter. It's limited. There's a restriction built into the nasty thing, built in by God himself or Christ himself who is ruling. And we have that again here. Because I mentioned before that in chapter 11, the holy city then, the church, gets trampled on. But notice that it gets trampled on for a certain period of time, doesn't it? Verse 2, it gets trampled on for 42 months. Now, 42 months is, as you will all immediately recognize, 3.5 years. And that kind of unit of time, it comes from Daniel. But again, I think we're to recognize it's a fraction. It's an incomplete period, because of course you know that in Revelation the number that represents completeness is 7. So 7 years, that would be a complete period. 3.5 years is a half period. So if the holy city were being trampled on for 84 months, for 7 years, then that would denote just complete trampling. The devil just being given absolute license to trample as he pleases. But the fact that no, he's allowed to trample the city for an incomplete period, for a half period, for 42 months, 3.5 years. It's underlining this point that his ability to attack the church is limited. It's significant, but it's limited. Now again, we're not to take it literally, and it's not saying that for precisely half of history Satan will be able to persecute the church and for precisely half of history he won't. That's not the point. It's just making this general point that Satan does not have license to attack as he pleases. But he's limited, he's restricted, because Christ is in control. And you see this in the New Testament, don't you? Think of the book of Acts. And the book of Acts documents great persecution against the Church of Jesus Christ. But it also documents moments where, really quite suddenly, the persecution just stops. I think it's chapter Acts 9, verse 31, I think, we have that. This is Saul of Tarsus, who of course was very much instigating a lot of the persecution. He has been converted. And we read Acts 9:31. So the church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria had peace and was being built up. And it's very, when you read Acts, it comes very suddenly that, because Saul has really been trying to completely wipe out the church. And it looked like he might succeed, but then suddenly Christ says, that's enough. I'm going to convert Saul, and I'm going to stop the persecution. He's in control, and that means that Satan's attacks are always limited. Secondly, Christ's control means that Satan's attacks are ineffective. Satan's attacks are ineffective. What I mean is ineffective with regard then to their target, which is Christ's people. They are unable to destroy Christ's people. In two ways, I think that comes across. First of all, they are unable to destroy the identity of Christ's people. Look at verse 1 of chapter 11. And in verse 1, we have this odd instruction given to John that he's to take a measuring rod and measure the temple. Now, the temple, I think, is again another picture of the church, of Christ's people. Of course, in other parts of the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians and Ephesians and elsewhere, Christ's people are likened to a temple, aren't they? And so, again then, in verse 1, we have the church. And John is told to measure it. And I think the measuring of the church then, it's a picture very similar to the earlier picture of the church being sealed. It's kind of God here measuring out his people. He knows exactly who his people are because he's going to protect them and he's going to keep them from being destroyed amidst all these attacks from Satan. So it's another picture of divine protection, really, this picture of measuring. But the strange thing is this, that it's kind of, it's to be the church is to be measured, verse 1, but then at the same time, verse 2, part of it is not to be measured. Do not measure the court outside the temple. Which seems a bit unnerving, that actually part of the church isn't to be protected. Part is, part isn't. That doesn't seem very comforting. But I think the point is this, that there is a dimension to Christ's people that is touchable to Satan and his attacks. Our health, he can attack that. Our wealth, he can attack that. Our social status, he can attack that. There are these external ways in which Satan can indeed damage us through persecution. There is a dimension to our existence where, if you like, we're not protected. We're not immune. We're not invulnerable. He can get at us. But equally, there's a dimension to our existence where we are absolutely invulnerable, where he can't get at us. Namely, our belonging to Christ, our existence as God's temple. He can't stop us being that. He can't stop us being Christians. He can't destroy us in that ultimate and absolute sense. He is ineffective to do that. That's what he'd like to do. He doesn't really want to just damage us in our bodies and in our wealth and social standing and so on. He really wants to pull us down to hell with him. But he can't do that. We're measured, we're sealed, we're protected in that ultimate sense. So Satan's attacks are ineffective. They can't destroy our identity. But then secondly, they can't destroy the witness of Christ's people. Now, witness is a big theme in this passage. I've already said that the church is likened then, is pictured as two witnesses. And it's this picture then of the church as a witnessing, a preaching community, a community with a message, a community that tells the world of salvation through Jesus Christ. Now, this witnessing theme, I think it throws us a lot, because like so much in Revelation, it's very much described in Old Testament terms. So even the fact there are two witnesses, that's Old Testament terminology, isn't it? Remember how in the law of Moses, there had to be two witnesses to any allegation, any accusation that was being brought. So for the purposes of attestation, there always had to be two witnesses. So that's kind of Old Testament imagery. Then again, the fact that these witnesses are clothed in sackcloth, verse 3. And I think that's a reference to Elijah, probably, in his strange garb. And again, it's just Old Testament imagery. Well, then again, what really throws us is verse 6. And the fact then that these witnesses have the power to shut the sky and all the rest of it. And you say, well, the church doesn't have these powers, so how can these two witnesses be the church? But again, it's just describing Old Testament prophets. That's what Old Testament prophets did. Elijah, he had the power to shut the sky. No rain fell for 3 years during Ahab's reign. And he had the power to call fire down, remember, on those soldiers who came to arrest him. So it's just emphasizing that the church is a witnessing community, and it's describing that in Old Testament imagery. Not to take the imagery literally, it's not the church can turn water into blood, it's just simply describing prophets, Old Testament witnesses, because we are their equivalent now. We proclaim the message of God's. But this is the point that I really wanted you to notice, that in verse 3 we're told that we will do this, the church will proclaim its message for 1,260 days. Now, 1,260 days, as again you'll all immediately recognize, is the same as 42 months. In other words, the church witnesses for no less time than the persecution. It witnesses throughout the whole length, the whole duration of the persecution. The persecution doesn't stop the witnessing happening. The persecution doesn't silence the church. The witnessing goes on just as long as the persecution goes on. That's the point. And we've seen it, haven't we, in our world. We see it in our world today. That in those places where God's message is where God's enemies try to silence God's message most strenuously, that message nonetheless gets heard. Think of Bibles being smuggled into countries where there was no liberty to preach the gospel. Think of today in the radio programs taking the gospel into the most closed countries of our world. People being converted through switching on their radio in a land where they couldn't possibly ever hear the gospel preached in the flesh. Because the gospel can't be silenced. The witnessing of Christ's church cannot be silenced. That's what Revelation 11 is teaching. For all these disturbing, powerful, horrible attacks of the evil one, they are ineffective to silence the gospel of Jesus Christ. So Satan's attacks are limited. Satan's attacks are ineffective. But then thirdly, and very much developing what we've just been saying, Satan's attacks are eclipsed. Attacks are eclipsed. Yes, they are this major theme of history in this AD period. A major theme of history is Satan attacking Christ's people. But there's an even more major theme than that. There's an even bigger theme in this AD period than Satan's war against the church. And it's this: the triumph of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the success of the gospel as it advances throughout the world. And that comes across then when you study carefully verses 7 to 13. What comes across in these verses is the ultimate counterproductiveness of Satan's attacks. That where Satan seems to attack the most strongly, not just is he ineffective, but actually the gospel triumphs as he attacks strongly. Let's trace what happens in those verses. So you'll notice that in verses 7 and 8 then, as we mentioned earlier, we have the beast, that is earthly powers, making war on Christ's people and really conquering them, and it seems final, it seems terminal, their dead bodies lying in the streets. And that happens at times, doesn't it, in parts of the world. Sometimes the church does look like it's being finished off. Sometimes the persecution is so intense it looks like the church is extinguished by it. But then there's a further development. Notice, by the way, how the church's enemies rejoice because they think that the church has been wiped out. Verse 10, they rejoice and make merry and exchange presents because, and it's not because they had found the church's witness unconvincing, it's because they had found it uncomfortable. The church's message had been a torment to them. Because it was a message that if you don't turn to Christ in repentance, then you will face the eternal consequences of that. And they didn't like that, and so they rejoice now that the church seems to have been extinguished. But then notice then that there's this further development. The church seems to have been wiped out here, but then verses 11 through 13, they speak very powerfully of resumption, of suddenly the church being able to resume its witness, kind of coming back from the dead. So verse 11, God breathes life back into his church that seems to have been snuffed out, and it revives. And then verse 12, which is a very misinterpreted verse, I think it's making a very simple point again. It's the picture of the resumption of prophetic witness. Look at verse 12, they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, come up here. We've had language just like that back in chapter 4, verse 1. After this is John speaking, I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice I heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this. What was that? It was John being commissioned as a prophet. And here then in verse 12 of chapter 11, it's simply the picture of the church again being, having its prophetic commission renewed, being given a new lease of life in its witness, its proclamation of the gospel. Verse 13 then, there's an earthquake, and again it's pictorial language, and it's again the idea of the church's message being resumed. Remember back in verse 6, the church's message, pictured in Old Testament language, was kind of bringing fire down from heaven, causing the rain to stop and all this kind of thing. And it's that kind of imagery again in verse 13, the church preaching this message and there's an earthquake. It's not literal, it's the church resuming its proclamation of the gospel. And notice then that this has a remarkable effect on the world itself. That as the enemies watch, verse 12, there's an emphasis on watching. We read that in verse 13, people were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. That's a remarkable thing. In other words, here where Satan has, it seems, destroyed the church, suddenly the church keeps on going. It resumes its work and witness. And unbelievers, it seems, are so amazed by that and seeing that such an attestation of the supernatural that they actually turn to God and start worshipping him themselves. You see what I mean by the counterproductiveness of Satan's attempts, people actually being converted through kind of his persecuting work. And again, we see that in our world, don't we? You see in places like North Korea and China, where suffering is most intense for Christians, people becoming Christians. Why? Well, surely one reason is because they see in the unsquashableness of the church, the indestructibleness of the church, they see a powerful attestation of the truth of the gospel, and so they want to become Christians themselves. The resilience of the church is itself such a testimony to the truth of the gospel, and people see that and they respond by coming to faith in Christ. And so yes, Satan is constantly attacking the church. And that's a pretty big thing that's going on in history. But this passage is saying there's something bigger going on. Christ is building his church. Christ is saving his elect. That multitude no man can number from chapter 7 is being gradually built up. And just as we close, there's one other part of our text that really underlines and confirms that. And it's back in chapter 10 again. And notice in chapter 10, we haven't mentioned verses 5 to 7, where we have this angel who's standing on the sea and on the land. That's Christ, you remember. And we have him taking an oath. And the oath is that in the days, verse 7, of the trumpet call, the oath is that there will be no more delay, but that in the days of the trumpet call to be sounded by the seventh angel, the mystery of God would be fulfilled. And what's the mystery of God? Well, we've talked about that in Ephesians in our previous Sunday morning series. Remember, Paul talks a lot about the mystery of God. Ephesians 1 and 3, he refers to the mystery. What's the mystery? Well, the mystery is the bringing together of Jewish and Gentile believers in one church. That's the emphasis in chapter 3. Or in chapter 1, it goes even further. The mystery is, it encompasses even more than that. It encompasses the bringing together of the whole universe that's so broken by the fall. It's going to be brought together and healed and restored at the end of time. And that's part of the mystery as well. In other words, the mystery is the gospel and its great effects of bringing Jews and Gentiles together, and even ultimately bringing the universe itself together. And here Christ is saying in verse 7 that the final trumpet, which we haven't got to yet, come to that next time, the final trumpet, which is the end of history, as we'll see next week, the final trumpet will coincide with the gospel finally culminating. And all Jewish and Gentile believers having been brought in to one church, one body, and even the universe itself finally on that last day being restored. And Christ here is swearing that this is going to happen. That regardless of all that Satan's doing, regardless of all the attacks, regardless of all the persecution, he's saying, I am going to make sure that the gospel reaches its great culmination and that all those millions who have been chosen from eternity are fully saved and that the physical world broken by the fall is restored and nobody's going to stop me. I'm swearing on oath that it's going to happen. Shouldn't we be encouraged by that this morning? Because we do live in a confusing world where Satan does sometimes seem to be having a field day. Let's be convinced of this, that Christ is actually having his way in this world, and Christ is building his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail. Amen.